Millions of Americans treat their high cholesterol with a class of drugs called statins. They are the first choice for doctors. But for many patients, the statins cause side effects, including muscle pain and headaches. A new drug approved in 2020 aims to help those who can't tolerate statins. And now, a new Cleveland Clinic-led study that took place in more than 30 countries shows the drug can reduce cardiovascular events, such as heart attacks. I'm Rick Jackson. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. We'll be talking to the Cleveland Clinic doctor who led the research on bempedoic acid. Dr. Stephen Nissen will discuss the study and what it means for patients who are managing high cholesterol. Later in the hour, we'll bring you the second episode of IdeaStream Public Media's new podcast, Living for We. It explores why Cleveland ranked last in livability metrics for Black women and what's being done to change and improve those outcomes. We'll get to both those topics after the latest national and local news. It is The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for joining us. Millions of people take prescription drugs known as statins to manage high cholesterol. Doctors prescribe statins as a first line of defense to help bring down cholesterol levels in the blood. But not everyone tolerates statins well and reports side effects such as muscle pain, headaches, and weakness. In 2020, the Food and Drug Administration approved bempedoic acid as an alternative drug to lower cholesterol for those unable to take statin medications. Now, a new Cleveland Clinic-led study shows that bempedoic acid can also reduce serious cardiovascular events. It's sold under the brand name Nexletol. The study was funded by Esperon Therapeutics, which is the developer of bempedoic acid. We are now joined to talk about this by telephone by Dr. Stephen Nissen, the study's lead author. He's the chief academic officer of the Heart, Vascular, and Thoracic Institute at the Cleveland Clinic. Dr. Nissen, welcome back to The Sound of Ideas.
Well, thank you for having me again. It's great to be with you.
Good to talk to you. Folks, if you'd like to join this conversation, there are several ways you can do that. The phone number 866-578-0903 or 216-578-0903. You can email us, soi@ideastream.org. I see some of you already have. Thanks for that. And you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Dr. Nissen, bempedoic acid's been approved as a cholesterol-lowering drug, as we said, since 2020. But this study, and it's a pretty large study, too, nearly 13,000 patients, the first to show that it helped protect against serious cardiovascular events.
That's right. First of all, the drug was approved, but wasn't widely used. In the current era, people want to have information that a drug has an effect on the things that patients really care about, heart attack, stroke, and death. And so we worked to design this study. It actually was 13,970 patients, almost 14,000 patients. And we followed them for an average of about 41 months. Half of them got a placebo pill, half of them got bempedoic acid, and the question was, what would happen? The primary outcome was a four-component composite of the adverse effects that patients experienced. That included heart attack, stroke, cardiovascular death, and the need for a bypass surgery or stenting in the coronaries. And on that outcome, there was a 13% reduction in those that took bempedoic acid. What's particularly striking was that heart attack was reduced by 23%, and the need for a stent or a bypass surgery was reduced by 19%. Death was not influenced, and that was not a surprise to us since, you know, we are pretty good at keeping people from dying, and that's a good thing when they come in with heart attacks and other disorders. So, death does not occur early on, but of course, if you've had multiple heart attacks, you are at increased risk of death. So eventually, I think that will be a benefit. We were pleased with the results, and we think this adds bempedoic acid to a group of drugs available to treat people with high cholesterol, but particularly offers a real opportunity for people who just can't tolerate statin drugs to take something that will reduce their cardiovascular risk.
Doctor, for folks who don't follow medical studies as closely as you and I might, is 23% a large number to see a change?
It is a large number. I mean, it's almost one in four. So, it probably was bigger than we expected. The drug worked particularly well, and it did two things. It lowered cholesterol levels. It lowered the levels of LDL cholesterol. That's the bad cholesterol. but it also reduced inflammation, which we measure by something known as C-reactive protein. And we think the combination of anti-inflammatory effects and cholesterol-lowering effects probably resulted in the very favorable result that we saw.
You mentioned that it was 41 months. I mentioned that it was 30-plus countries. This is a large study. What did you do to make sure that everybody was involved? I imagine there's ethnic diversity considerations, racial diversity considerations. How'd you choose the people?
Oh, it's just a real challenge. First of all, we had 1,250 research sites in 32 countries. So really big study. And we were able to achieve something that is very unusual. We had 48% women in this study, and we had 17% Hispanic patients. And we encouraged the sites to find people that look like the patients that we treat. So many of the clinical trials that are done have studied, you know, white men, and we don't get information about women and about other ethnic groups. So this was something we worked very hard at, and we were quite successful. And, of course, having many countries helps us to get a diverse population.
Of course. Doc, we've already got calls, tweets, and emails coming in. Jim wanted to know, is the muscle pain? He says it's because these statins destroy chemicals that the heart needs, which causes a deficiency. Is he correct? And how do bempedoic acids work differently than statins, which do cause those side effects he referenced?
Yeah, well, first of all, statins are wonderful drugs, and please don't anybody misunderstand. If you can tolerate a statin, and most people can, probably, you know, 85%, maybe 90% of people can tolerate a statin, you should take it. Now, bempedoic acid is a designer drug. When you take it, it is inactive, so that as it distributes into tissues, including muscles, it's inactive. But it gets taken up by the liver, and the liver converts it to an active form, where it then reduces the bad cholesterol, LDL. And so this is just an opportunity to develop a drug that was really designed to help patients who can't tolerate a statin.
To that point, got another email from James this time saying he takes 40 milligrams of atorvastatin daily, no detected side effects. For people who don't have side effects, is there any advantage at all to switching to the new drug?
There really isn't an advantage. It's not our advice to switch. Statins have been studied in hundreds of thousands of patients and have produced very strong results, you know, very similar results to what we saw, but, you know, across a much bigger population, many more studies, and there is an advantage of statins. They're generic. All but one of them are generic, including atorvastatin, which this patient is taking. And that means they're very inexpensive, just a few dollars a month. The drug we studied, bempedoic acid, is still proprietary, so it is a little bit more costly. And what's good about the study is now that we have evidence of a benefit, then insurance carriers are very likely to cover the treatment with this drug, with bempedoic acid. Many of them were not willing to cover the drug previously.
And you were saying there's a difference. I saw something like $400 a month versus $10 for
yes.
The basic status.
No question about it. And that's another good reason why if statins work for you and you're tolerating the statins well, you should stay on them. Now, there is one other use for bempedoic acid that we didn't study, and that's to give it on top of statins. We studied people who simply couldn't take statins.
Right.
And they had to confirm that they couldn't take statins, and their doctors had to confirm it. But the drug is also being used by some practitioners to produce additional lowering of cholesterol on top of statins, and I think it may see some increased use for that purpose.
Yeah, we'd gotten a tweet that was kind of asking that same question, saying, given the reduced heart attack risk, could this be appropriate for people who can take the regular statins? So you say in some cases, yes.
Yeah, in some cases, yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. When people are navigating their health choices, how should they consider funding for studies like this? This was largely paid for by the drug's maker. but your research findings, I imagine, are independent of funding.
Well, that is just a terrific question. I'm very proud of the fact that we have an organization at Cleveland Clinic that I lead known as C5 Research. And what C5 Research does is it independently analyzes clinical trials. This study was done in collaboration with the sponsor, but the data all came to the Cleveland Clinic where our statisticians did the analyses. That allows us to stand behind the data knowing that it was independently analyzed. And those folks who know my history know that I've been very outspoken about drugs that work and drugs that don't work. And I think that is an ethical responsibility for researchers, and we have taken that very seriously here. I have about 85 people here that help me do these clinical trials, including a wonderful group of statisticians. So these are data we can stand behind with the strength of knowing that we did the analysis ourselves.
Mm-hmm. We talked about side effects for statins. Are there side effects reported by users of the bempedoic?
There are. The drug increases a circulating substance known as uric acid, which is associated with gout. And there was about a 1% absolute increase in the risk of gout in the study that we did. A study, by the way, is known as CLEAR Outcomes. And there was about a 1% increase in the risk of gallstones. Now, we think those are I wouldn't call them minor, but I would say that they're not nearly as important as the benefits that we saw. And there's one more nuance here that some listeners will understand. The statin drugs, while they are really effective, do slightly increase blood sugar, which means they slightly increase the risk of developing diabetes. Bempedoic acid does not. There were actually fewer patients developing diabetes in our trial who took bempedoic acid compared with those that took placebo. Now, that difference wasn't statistically significant, but there was no increase in the risk of diabetes, and that may be an advantage for some people who are on the borderline and who really want to avoid developing diabetes. However, it should be noted that even though statins slightly increase the risk of diabetes, having diabetes while on a statin does not diminish the benefits of statins. So people shouldn't stop statins simply because their blood sugar goes up a little bit.
Talking with Dr. Stephen Nissen of the Cleveland Clinic about this new statin alternative. I had a message from Donna. She wrote in, and you answered the first part, can you take a statin and the new drug? But she also wanted to know, do statins also have an anti-inflammatory effect?
Yes, that's a very good question. They do. However, it does vary by the type of statin and by the dose. A strong anti-inflammatory effect is seen with the top doses of statins. You know, we're talking about, 40 to 80 milligrams of atorvastatin or, 20 to 40 milligrams of rosuvastatin, which are the most commonly used drugs. Bempedoic acid is only available in one dose, and that dose did produce quite a strong anti-inflammatory effect.
Mm-hmm. Many Americans are being or will be treated for high cholesterol. Why so many?
I think our contemporary American lifestyle is not the best. If you look at primitive populations, you go to people who live off the land and, eat primarily, vegetable materials. The natural cholesterol in those populations is low. It's much lower than it is in Western countries like the United States. I think we've just come to have diets that are really not very good. There's also a genetic component here. And a lot of people say, well, I can lower my cholesterol by dieting. And the problem is that generally you can't lower it very much with dieting. Maybe 10 or 15% lowering. We get much greater lowering of cholesterol with statins and with bempedoic acid. But I wish the whole population had lower levels, but we're just not going to see that. There are too many fast food restaurants, too many people eat in those restaurants, and if you look at the content of the food that people are eating, it's not very healthy.
You know, we talk about high cholesterol and the so-called BAD or LDL, low-density lipoprotein cholesterol. We didn't really define what makes it dangerous for people who are listening and don't really pay attention to cholesterol.
Yeah. So LDL cholesterol, it accumulates in the walls of the blood vessels, in the heart, in the brain, and in every other artery. And eventually, that leads to narrowings, which may produce, you know, chest pain or other symptoms. And if one of those plaques that are accumulating that have LDL cholesterol, if that plaque ruptures, a clot forms, and that's what causes a heart attack or a stroke. If you can prevent the formation of the plaques, then you prevent the heart attacks and strokes. And that's exactly what cholesterol lowering has been shown to do. And interestingly enough, it is our research done here over many years that first showed that we can stop the development of plaques in the coronaries with cholesterol-lowering drugs, and we can even, in about two-thirds of patients, shrink the plaques that have already formed. So that's why we need to be so vigilant about treating LDL cholesterol.
Okay. To that point, and I got an email here that I can't verify, but I'll read it and ask your opinion here. Sheila writes in to say that your colleague, Dr. Mark Hyman of the Functional Medicine Group at the clinic, said cholesterol is not the problem, doesn't necessarily need to be controlled. Is she correct in what Dr. Hyman she's quoting? How do you respond to that?
It is not correct. That is bad information, and it's a problem that we have here is that, you know, the internet is just filled with misinformation about cholesterol. And you know, these folks that are advocating that somehow cholesterol is not the problem, the evidence that cholesterol is the problem is overwhelming. And, you know, 99%+ of all physician scientists agree about that. A few do not, and they make a lot of noise, and they convince people, and such thinking is dangerous.
Okay, and that's why I quoted the email and not Dr. Hyman, and my producer is looking it up now and says, Dr. Hyman says cholesterol is not the only factor, not that it's not a factor. So it's glad we can both clear that up.
Yeah, I agree, but it is the most important factor.
Last thing before I let you go, we're getting short on time. What options are there for people who maybe are hesitant to take prescription drugs? Are there any lifestyle changes that manage LDL supplements?
Well, first of all, dietary supplements are fundamentally 21st century snake oil. What I tell my patients is go home, take all your dietary supplements and flush them down the toilet. In fact, we did a study, got a lot of press attention, called the SPORT Trial, where we took the six most commonly used dietary supplements to lower cholesterol, and we tested them. And none of them had any benefits except one, garlic, actually increased LDL cholesterol. So don't rely upon dietary supplements. They're not regulated by the FDA. There's no safety data about them, and patients should simply not rely upon them to lower their cholesterol.
I'm going to use your line, 21st century snake oil. Thanks for that. Dr. Stephen Nissen's with the Cleveland Clinic. Thank you for the information today.
Yep. Okay.
Always
great to be with you.
Always good talking to you.
Wonderful talking to you. And, you know, best to all the patients out there that are struggling with their cholesterol. And, you know, obviously we're eager to help.
Yeah, a lot of us have atorvastatin in the closet, certainly. Thank you.
Yeah, okay.
We'll take a short break here. When we return, we'll bring you episode 2 of IdeaStream Public Media's new podcast series, Living for We. You're listening to The Sound of Ideas. You're listening to The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Earlier this month, IdeaStream launched a new podcast exploring why Cleveland ranked last in terms of livability metrics for Black women. Living for We explores the health and wellness challenges created by those metrics and looks at what's being done to improve outcomes. IdeaStream Public Media's Director of Engaged Journalism, Marlene Harris-Taylor, hosts the podcast. In this week's episode, she talks to two women who found themselves in public and painful situations. First, we'll hear from Samaria Rice, mother of Tamir Rice. He's a 12-year-old who was killed by Cleveland police, shot outside a Cleveland Recreation Center. Later, Marlene talks with Aisha Bell Hardaway, the interim monitor overseeing Cleveland police reform. We have the episode also with psychologist Dr. Angela Neal Barnett. She discusses how Black women are expected to act with grace even as they endure heightened public scrutiny. We hand it off now to Marlene Harris-Taylor and episode 2 of Living for We.
In January of 2020, Bloomberg City Lab published an article about a new study from Pittsburgh researchers naming the best and worst cities for Black women. Among cities with at least 100,000 Black women, Cleveland came in dead last in terms of livability. In this city with a nearly 50% Black population, this news dropped like a bomb. And reactions were mixed. Do you think Cleveland is really the worst for Black women? And what do you say?
I say...
It depends on the person I ask. When I dropped it in one of my Black girl group chats, the emojis were just eye rolls.
I'm not surprised. Not even a little.
It's heartbreaking and also embarrassing.
Is it like this everywhere? Is it me?
This city will make or break you.
We have a city of Black women that are looking around at their outcomes, their future, their past, and saying, this city makes me anxious.
If anybody's out there listening in Cleveland, please get out.
On Living for We talk to Cleveland's Black women from all walks of life, from the CEO of one of our major healthcare systems to self-starting entrepreneurs, judges, lawyers, doctors, artists, students, and mothers who've experienced loss. We share stories from these women as change makers and architects of their own futures, celebrating their victories, challenges, and personal growth along the way. So, is it really true what they say? Is Cleveland deserving of the least livable title? And what can we do to make lasting improvements for Black women in our city? I'm Marlene Harris-Taylor, and this is Living for We, a project of connecting the dots between race and health from IdeaStream Public Media. Welcome in, everyone. On this episode of Living for We, we're going deep, but it's not an unfamiliar place. As Black women, what did we always hear our mothers say? They told us we had to work 10 times harder than white people. And when we get to positions of success, we can't afford to miss a step or it'll all get snatched away. A content note, though, before we get started today, this episode includes conversations about police violence, including recordings of 911 dispatcher and police communications. What's Cleveland like for Black women when they find themselves in the white hot light of controversy and public scrutiny? How do they cope? Sometimes Black women who don't seek the spotlight are thrust into the public eye through some circumstance or tragedy. Like our first guest today, one of the most well-known women from Cleveland, Samaria Rice, the mother of Tamir Rice, who was just 12 years old when he was killed by a police officer while playing with a toy gun in a Cleveland park in 2014. On that day, dispatchers were told that Tamir's toy gun was a real pistol.
I'm sitting in the park at West Boulevard by the West Boulevard Rapid Transit Station. He's like pointing at everybody.
In the park by the youth center, there's a Black male sitting on the swings. So he keeps pulling a gun out of his pants and pointing it at people.
Even after shots were fired, police were still convinced they were dealing with a grown man.
Shots fired, male down, Black male, maybe 20.
Tamir's murder quickly became national news. Yet another infamous case of police brutality against a Black citizen taken to the furthest extreme.
We are joined now by Tamir's mother, Samaria Rice. What would you like to see happen right now?
I'm looking for a conviction for both of the officers.
Mm-hmm.
200 protesters making a strong message to Cuyahoga County Prosecutor Timothy McGinty that they want action in Tamir Rice's case.
And as these things often go, years after Tamir's murder, after fighting and pushing for prosecution of the officer who shot her son, Samaria learned that after losing him in such a tragic way, the police would go free without being indicted by local or federal authorities.
Representing Tamir's mother, Samaria Rice, says the family found out the case would be closed through reporting from the New York Times and the Washington Post.
Ms. Rice feels that it was blatantly disrespectful that she had to learn from the media that the Department of Justice had shut down the investigation.
Tamir would be 20 years old now. Samaria says she's surviving and thriving because of her other children. She has a son, two daughters, and four grandchildren. She must be there for them, she says, and because she's fighting for Tamir's legacy.
What I experienced was mental abuse that America has allowed to keep happening to Black and brown people over the centuries. It's a lot to deal with, you know. America has taken away from me what my son would look like as a teenager and a young man and even an old man. I don't know what my son gonna never look like.
Samaria Rice joined me for a conversation about her experiences in the public eye in the city of Cleveland and on the national stage. Samaria understandably does not feel that Cleveland is a good place for Black women and Black mothers, especially those raising Black boys.
At this point, the system is broken. It's really nothing that I can think about it, is that it's white supremacy work, white supremacy at its best. I'm speaking truth and I'm speaking facts. I didn't ask them people to put my son's name on the face over there in Jordan and over there in Saudi Arabia and march down the street. I didn't ask them to do that. There's nothing I can do with that. They have to deal with God with that. That's why I can be political. I know I have the power that I have. I don't use it to my advantage. You know, I'm trying to be chill till it's that time. I'm not trying to end up like Malcolm. I ain't trying to end up like Martin. You know what I'm saying? I'm not trying to end up like them people.
You're not trying to be a martyr.
My thing is I'm trying to build up the Black woman and the Black man to get their mind strong enough that, listen, these white people not gonna play with us. Okay, look at what's going on. And when you talk about reparations, they can just give us the land and whatever money is there, okay? Because they gonna always, they got old rich white money. They ain't gonna never run out of money. You understand?
At the end of the day, Samaria has experienced immeasurable amounts of trauma. And the trauma of losing a child to a random act of violence, it's all too common in Cleveland. So what would you like other Black mothers who have lost their sons to gun violence, what would you like them to know? Is there anything you could share with them?
You can be right there in poverty and you can still come out as a flower. Look at me. Look what happened to me. But it did take something tragic to happen to me. But they don't have to wait till the tragic happened. They can get with support groups. If it's some out there, they can check in with their mental wellness, making sure that you get the right fit. Don't get with nobody that think they gonna tell you how to live or how to think. Now they do give you suggestions. You have to be willing to listen and take what you wanna take from that. You know what I'm saying? There is professional help out there.
Samaria, born and raised in Cleveland, has moved on from the city as a home base. The city of Cleveland eventually agreed to a financial settlement with her family. But Samaria says it doesn't change what happened, and it doesn't make Cleveland any more comfortable for her. But that doesn't mean she's given up on the future of Cleveland for Black women and families. She still has family in Cleveland, and the Tamir Rice Foundation and Afrocentric Cultural Center, which she's very proud of, is in Cleveland. But when asked about the study ranking Cleveland as the least livable city for Black women in America, she didn't hold back.
If anybody's out there listening in Cleveland, please get out. Please, if you can, please get out.
You have the advantage of, you know, being away from Cleveland now and looking back, you know, have a broader view. So what, in your estimation, could really make real change for Black women in Cleveland?
Well, if Cleveland will stop being a crab in the bucket, number one, and start supporting one another in the way that they should support, stabbing each other in the back, trying to get ahead, trying to not help the next sister up. It's just a shame. And what also makes it so bad as a Black woman in Cleveland, there's no stand-up man. You know, where are the men at? You're like, guarding us and watching us, patrolling our streets and stuff like that, watching our children. Where are y'all?
The Cleveland Police Department has been involved in several high-profile use of force incidents over the last decade, including the infamous 137 shots case that led to the deaths of two unarmed motorists, Timothy Russell and Melissa Williams, in 2012. Their murders moved state and local officials to ask the U.S. Department of Justice, also known as the DOJ, to launch an investigation into the local police department.
Looked at hundreds of cases that included gun-toting rogue officers inflaming routine situations, slanting their after-action reports, or not writing them at all. Attorney General Holder says Cleveland is one of 20 police departments across the country undergoing a Justice Department review.
I think we certainly see patterns where you see inadequate training, where you see resource deficiencies, where you see cultural problems that exist within police departments.
That multi-year investigation was already underway when Tamir was killed. The DOJ's final scathing report was ironically released just 12 days after the fatal shooting of Tamir. It chastised the department for repeated, quote, unreasonable and unnecessary use of force, end quote. Okay, we're about to talk about this thing called a consent decree. And I know it's very confusing. I was confused too when I first moved here to Cleveland and I started hearing about it. And what I eventually figured out is that the consent decree is about the Cleveland Police Department. The fact that they have been involved in so many use of force incidents. So the Department of Justice wanted to make sure that there were changes. So they put a judge in charge to make sure that there is real reform in the Cleveland Police Department. That effort to reform the police started in June 2015, and it's ongoing to this day. The consent decree created a need for a monitoring team to evaluate the police department's positive progress. Our next guest, Aisha Bell Hardaway, is a law professor at Case Western Reserve University Law School and the director of its Social Justice Law Center. She was appointed to the monitoring team in 2015 and then promoted to deputy monitor in 2019. But things took a turn in May of 2021 when Aisha joined a panel on IdeaStream Public Media's morning show, The Sound of Ideas. She shared her opinion about the murder conviction of the police officer who killed George Floyd.
Aisha Bell Hardaway, would you agree this trial was framed, though, as a case against Derek Chauvin, not a case against police in general?
Yes, absolutely. The state's attorneys made that a point, especially in their closing argument, that this is about one man and not about policing generally. This is not an anti-police case, one of the assistant prosecutors mentioned. And that just goes to show how much we don't trust the general American public to have an honest and frank conversation and reckoning with the violence and the harm that continues to be inflicted against Black communities through law enforcement, through what's being called law enforcement in these moments. And that's problematic. That's why I think this case was really just low-hanging fruit. And when we talk about, hopefully this is a turning point, I believe, you know, we've heard so many leaders say that, including the president. When folks have made it a point to cabin this case off as an outlier, it really doesn't give me a lot of confidence that we're prepared and willing to ensure that, you know, the Dante Wrights and the Makia Bryants don't continue to happen.
That response that might sound measured to some stirred up an unbelievable amount of trouble for Aisha. Cleveland's police monitor at the time, Hassan Aden, and many other folks involved in the consent decree monitoring process began to question Aisha's qualifications as a member of the monitoring team. Aiden attempted to move her into a different position, one that would strip her of her monitoring duties. And ultimately, that's what forced her to resign.
I think the word that they used was like that it wasn't objective. I can't even begin to pretend to understand it. But I do know, right, that every day I wake and interact in this world, I am seen and I am a Black woman. And that can mean something good to some people and it can mean something bad to some.
But do you think it played into that particular set of circumstances that happened?
Of course.
In what way?
There were some things about both my background and my racial demographic, my gender, right, that made folks feel very much like, how dare she? How dare she?
To your point of not being objective and saying things that revealed that you weren't objective, and that must have been hurtful.
And using it for their own political gain and right. just weird stuff, you know, the way that that happens. Yeah. And I had to, like, really just stay focused on why I was involved in the first place and being and the community spoke very, very loudly. You know, there wasn't a question of what people wanted, even where I was kind of like, I don't have to be there. People, if folks really feel like I'm a problem, you know, like, fine, you know, I'll go, but I won't go. I'm not going to just sit here and be relegated to, you know, a face on your website, you know, or a name that you get to tout when you want to. Yeah. And community spoke really clearly. So.
Yes, they did.
Members of the Norman S. Minor Bar Association, Cleveland branches of NAACP and Black Lives Matter are calling for Belle Hardaway to be reinstated immediately.
The monitor was not put in place to be a friend of the Cleveland Police Department.
Professor Hardaway is the only person that has been a continuous expert relative to the Cleveland Police Consent.
There was an immediate and loud community outcry upon the news of Aisha's forced resignation. Without her on the team, there was not a single local Black person responsible for monitoring the police department. And yet, through all the chaos, all the backlash, and all of the blatant disrespect, Aisha kept an immaculate demeanor, as many Black women are expected to do. We're human. You know, we could be some petty individuals, us human beings. And it's hard not to get caught up in our feelings, you know? So just even being able to rise above that, I think that's incredible. But I think it's also something that Black women have had to do in so many spaces, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think that's healthy.
Michelle Obama, when they go low, we go high.
Yeah, I don't even think about it that way. I mean, yes, I think that it's important to put those sort of like parameters or make those analogies. All of that's helpful in crystallizing the point. But the reality of this for me is that your opinion and your attempts to move me, your attempts to discredit me don't really get to occupy that space. I'm not giving you that power. It's not necessarily like, oh, I think I'm better than or I'm more spiritual than or whatever, right? Like, this just needs to be put in its proper place.
And let's just say, sometimes justice has a way of working itself out, even if that's a rare occasion for Black women. Hassan Aiden, the one responsible for pushing Aisha out, was forced to ask her to return to the monitoring team following the community's dismay at her departure. She rejoined, and Hassan has since stepped down as police monitor. And guess who is in his role now? Miss Aisha Belle Hardaway.
Yeah, I mean, I just think, you know, the way things work out, okay.
I mean, life is interesting the way it works out, right?
It can be interesting. I still regret that it was a thing that happened at all, especially when we care so much about the work. These sideshows are tough, right? They're distractions. They're opportunities for the work not to be moving forward. And I never, ever want to be at the center of anything that's costing us, right, progress.
That's the thing with both Aisha and Samaria's stories.
While obviously not the same, they're both painful public affairs. But each of them found their own way to cope. Samaria through spending time with her family, working to build Tamir's legacy, and Aisha through focusing on the bigger picture of her work and just how important police reform is in the city of Cleveland and to her personally. Unsurprisingly, trauma is a word that's going to come up time and time again throughout this season of Living for We. Black women are expected to overachieve, overperform, and live their lives gracefully while simultaneously carrying deep trauma, consciously and unconsciously, through explicit and subtle acts of aggression, and while caring for family often fractured by violence, disadvantage, years of discrimination, and of course, pre-existing generational trauma. Countless Black women's lives are shaped by the adversities they face, and that's why we're calling in the expert. Dr. Angela Neal Barnett will be our resident psychologist throughout this season of Living for We.
I am a licensed clinical psychologist, and I tend to do group interventions. One of the things that is important to understand is that racism, in all of its forms, is a stressor, and it is a chronic stressor. And what happens then, we have so many of the things that have happened in this country, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, Tatiana Jefferson, Jaylen Walker.
Tamir Rice,
absolutely. That those things for us switch racism from a chronic stressor to trauma. And it is that chronic stress plus the traumatic stress leads to toxic stress. So what happens is that the cortisol, which is a stress hormone, protects us. But if you're facing this day in, day out, at some point it becomes depleted. It can no longer protect us. We're just out there vulnerable and just absorbing in that toxic stress. The issue is not race. The issue is racism.
One of the themes that we're talking about in today's episode is that sometimes as Black women, we're thrust into the spotlight. Sometimes we're not seeking that spotlight, but it's thrust upon us.
Yeah.
And we spoke with Samaria Rice. It's unimaginable to me, the trauma that she has gone through.
Yes. And yet she has taken that and made it her life's work to bring about change.
You know, if you were talking to Samaria, if you were her therapist, or when you have people in the chair that you're talking to who have gone through a major loss like that, is that something that you advise them to do to find another purpose?
One of the things that we know in grief counseling is that it is important to find purpose.
Unfortunately, in Cleveland, there's many, many Black women dealing with loss.
Yes.
Who are grieving. Yes. They're grieving the loss of a child, maybe not at the hands of the police, but maybe at the hands of someone else from their community.
One of the things that we hear all the time, particularly from people who have multiple loss, is that, you mean this has a name? Grief, trauma, stress. I just thought this was the way it was supposed to be. When you can name it, when you can educate, when you can make interventions available, that gives people hope.
That gives them some hope that there can be something different.
There's hope that that there can be something different. Hope is the key to healing.
But how do you start, though, to get somebody to that place when they come to you? And maybe it's fresh, or maybe it's been a year or two. Where do you start?
So you start by listening. What happened? How are you feeling? When they say, I'm not getting over, this is just, I just can't get over this. Then you don't say things like, oh, well, you should, let me help you. You're saying things like, well, tell me about it. Where are you getting stuck? What's going on? It's just about active, what we call active listening, which is that you don't talk about yourself and you don't make a basic idea.
And you don't try to say, well, you know what? I understand what you're going through because I went through something similar and then talk about your story.
Talk about your story. And that doesn't help anybody. Rarely have people been able to tell their story from beginning to end.
Like what Samaria went through. And she's experiencing this same grief, this same out-of-body experience, but yet there's all this attention.
And she's supposed to then somehow get up in front of cameras, because she talks about that. You know, they expect me to get up, and they didn't want me to be angry, because, you know, all these kinds of things. And so what they were saying is, don't go out there looking like you're a grieving mother. And how can you not? You know, we have these expectations of people. We're going to be the noble parent, be above this, and talk about hope and healing when we have just lost our baby. If you listen, particularly if you listen to mothers, this grief is always, I mean, it may not be as intense, as in your face as it was in the beginning, but it's always there. It's just always there.
And I can imagine that. As a mother, I have not lost a child in that way. But I have a young Black man that I'm raising. He's almost a grown-up now. He'll be 21 soon. But as a Black mother with a young Black son, there's this angst and anxiety that's always like under the surface. And, you know, he may be going out for just a fun night with his friends. But in the back of my mind, I know all mothers experience this to a certain extent, being worried about your child. But there's this other level.
There's a reason why we see those boys, those men, call out for their mamas. And when they do, there's a reason that every Black mother in this country hears her name.
Oh, my God. You're so right. You're so right. I mean, I cannot. It's almost too much for me to even listen to them calling for their mother, because I can hear my son's voice.
That's why we say to people, don't watch. Don't watch.
We do, unfortunately, get confronted with these things over and over again on a loop.
And that's trauma. That's trauma. And that's depleting us. That's why we had what people refer to as a racial reckoning with George Floyd, because we didn't know to avoid the video. So, you know, there it was in our face. And collectively, as Black Americans, we all fell apart or went off. Or both.
you know, we did. We really did. That's a good way to describe it. We fell apart.
And when people didn't give us a beat, we went off even more. We were like, do you know what happened? No, I'm not sending you that memo. No, I'm not going out there and covering the story. No, I'm not defending your client. And no, I'm not teaching class.
So let's talk about our other guest, Aisha Bell Hardaway, another woman who was thrust into the spotlight.
Black women don't get second chances. You'll hear us say we have to be twice as good to go half as far. And we don't get second chances. What Aisha did was say, I'm going to be transparent. And I'm going to say what happened, and I am not. Because we don't get second chances, people think we'll just run under the bed and hide, you know, or we'll go back into academia and do whatever it is we were doing. But she realized she had been chosen for a purpose, and she was not going to run and hide. She was going to be transparent and stand up for what she was doing and the importance of what she was doing.
Taking back that sense of control.
Taking back the narrative, taking back control.
As Aisha talked about how the support from the community, from the Black community, was fast.
Yes.
And it was steadfast. Eventually, others came to support her as well, but the Black community came first.
Yes.
And one of the other themes that we hear from so many of the guests is having that circle of Black girlfriends. It's so important.
Absolutely. Wonderful poem by Gloria Wade Gales called "And the Women Gathered." Black women have always gathered around each other. And as long as we continue to do that, I mean, that's what allows you to stand.
If you're a Black woman in Cleveland and want to share your thoughts with us directly, our hotline is open. Leave a voicemail at 216-223-8312. That's 216-223-8312. And you may just hear yourself on the podcast. On our next episode, we get to work, literally. We begin our exploration into Black women's experiences in the workforce in Cleveland, often as the only one of us in the room.
The moment that you decide you want to speak out, you're combative, you're difficult, you're hard to work with, you're angry, you're emotional. This may not be the line of work for you.
And I wonder, like anyone else walking down the street dressed nice, would they say to them, what do you do?
No matter what letters you have behind your name, your education, people will still look at you as just a little Black girl.
That's next time on Living for We.
That was the second episode of Living for We, a podcast from IdeaStream produced in collaboration with Cleveland's Enlightened Solutions. It drops every other week. We'll bring you those episodes here on The Sound of Ideas. To get the last word on today's topic, send an email, soi@ideastream.org. We're also on Twitter, @SoundOfIdeas. Now, yesterday, for last word, Dr. Emmett Jolly, president of the Shaker Heights City School District Board of Education, emailed us to push back on our discussion on the idea of Black flight happening in Shaker Heights. We had spoken with New York Times reporter and Shaker native Deborah Kamen. Dr. Jolly writes, quote, "The advantage of the NYT article in that pulpit is that it encouraged us to review the data around our district, a self-assessment. The results were contradictory to the Times article and to comments made today. It showed there was neither an exodus of Black students to private schools nor to nearby public schools. We do not want to lose any of our students in Shaker and are continuing to understand the reasons why some families choose Shaker to be their home and some families choose to leave. There are real challenges to building an equitable environment in Shaker Heights. We are proud of our effort and commitment to excellence, inclusion, and equity for all students." Thank you, Dr. Jolly. Tomorrow we talk about this year's Cleveland's Humanities Festival. I'm Rick Jackson. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you tomorrow.